We like to think we are, the architects of our own lives. We build our daily routines, we set up our 5-year plans, we manage our relationships, and it all feels very, I mean, very structured.
Right.
Yeah, very controlled.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very controlled. But today's deep dive pulls from a really provocative, totally unapologetic article that basically argues our neat little lives are actually built on matchsticks.
And human desire is the match.
Yes. Welcome to the deep dive. We are exploring a 2026 Hebrew article by Chen Shalhok titled, in translation, Women's Lust Equals Between Destruction and Human Building.
Right. And it is just a really raw look at how the singular drive of sexual desire can be the bedrock of a strong home or, the very spark that burns it completely to the ground.
It really forces you to confront a landscape of human emotion that is incredibly volatile. But we should probably establish right away the specific framework we're navigating today.
Definitely, because the author operates within a highly traditional, strictly religious worldview.
He holds some very definitive opinions on gender dynamics, religious mysticism, and ancient societal rules. So our goal here isn't to take sides or endorse these viewpoints.
Right, exactly. We are just stepping into his framework to impartially unpack the mechanics of his argument, to see what it reveals about his particular perspective on human nature.
Which is such a fascinating perspective to dissect, honestly. Because his whole argument hinges on a very specific core tension.
The battle between the human intellect and our animal nature.
Yes. He posits that humanity was granted intellect for one primary reason, and that is to act as the brakes on our biological drives.
But he argues those brakes don't just fail all at once, do they? Like the fall into infidelity or the destruction of a marriage, it never starts with a catastrophic explosion.
No, not at all. He describes it as this terrifyingly gradual slip. The intellect doesn't just switch off, it erodes.
It's a slow burn.
Exactly. It begins with just a fleeting thought that you don't immediately banish. And because you entertain that thought, it morphs into a lingering glance. And that glance lowers the barrier just enough to allow a casual, overly familiar word. And then that word paves the way for an action.
Wow. So by the time the actual action happens, the intellect has already been quietly dismantled piece by piece?
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if desire is this consuming, destructive force that slowly dismantles our intellect, I mean, the logical assumption would be that we should just extinguish it entirely.
Right. If you have a dangerous fire, you stamp it out.
Exactly. But the author says a resounding no to that instinct, which leads into what I found to be the most surprising part of the text. His fierce, almost aggressive critique of religious asceticism.
Oh, he does not hold back.
Not at all.
He launches this massive polemic
Pop.
against what he calls foolish Kabbalists and certain mystics who try to do exactly what you just suggested,
Stamp out the fire.
stamp it out entirely. And to understand why he's so angry at them, you have to look at the historical context of asceticism. Many mystical traditions historically viewed the physical world and the physical body as inherently corrupted. Their logic was that to elevate the spiritual soul, you basically had to actively suppress physical desires.
Right. So they started implementing these dark, invented restrictions right in the marital bedroom.
Yeah.
Like he mentions rules dictating that intimacy could only happen after midnight or perhaps only once a week, specifically on the Sabbath.
Right. Supposedly to align with some cosmic mystical alignment.
And he views those rules not as holy, but as deeply destructive.
Yes, he essentially accuses these mystics of poisoning the one place where intimacy is actually supposed to flourish.
And what's striking is that he doesn't just use his own opinion to fight back against these mystics. He brings in Maimonides, the Rambam.
Who is an absolute historical heavyweight in this tradition.
Exactly. He points out that Maimonides ruled mutual marital intimacy is entirely permissible, natural, and healthy in whatever way the couple chooses. The author is using this foundational philosopher to say, look, the greatest minds in our history view this physical connection as a core, healthy part of a marriage, not some shameful secret you have to wrap in terrifying mystical red tape.
What's fascinating here is it creates this incredible intellectual clash. You have the mystic saying the body is a trap to be avoided, and the rationalist, Maimonides, saying the body is a tool to be utilized.
And the author forcefully sides with the rationalist.
Absolutely, because he applies a really profound psychological insight here. He says enforcing fear, restriction, and, artificial scarcity in a marriage, It doesn't eliminate desire.
It just creates a massive aching void.
Exactly.
It's like trying to cap a geyser by just throwing a heavier rock over the hole. You aren't eliminating the pressure underneath. You're just guaranteeing that when it finally blows, it takes the whole landscape with it.
It's a great analogy.
So does he actually believe that being too strict about religious purity is what ultimately leads to infidelity?
He absolutely believes that. If you tell a couple that their physical connection is somehow spiritually dangerous, unless timed perfectly to the stars, you generate immense anxiety.
You strip all the joy and the warmth right out of the relationship.
Exactly. The natural consequence is a home full of frustrated, neglected spouses.
Mm-hmm.
And human psychology dictates that we just cannot survive in a vacuum of affection.
We need it.
We do. So if spouses are denied validation and physical connection at home because of these foolish restrictions, they will inevitably, almost biologically, start scanning the horizon for the warmth they're being denied.
And that void doesn't just sit there empty, waiting politely to be fixed. It actively pulls things in.
Yes.
Which brings us to how the author views the modern world, specifically how that dangerous void gets filled outside the home. He issues a very stark warning about the everyday, mundane hazards of feeling neglected.
He really paints a painfully relatable picture of how this vulnerability manifests.
Yeah.
He asks you to imagine an ignored wife who receives a tiny, seemingly innocent compliment on her clothes or her makeup from a total stranger.
Right.
Right.
Or a husband who feels constantly criticized or disrespected at home, suddenly receiving a kind, validating word from a colleague at work.
I mean, from the outside, those moments just look like basic human politeness.
Yeah, totally harmless.
But in his view, because that void is sitting there wide open, those tiny compliments are acute existential dangers. They are the water seeping right into the cracks of the foundation.
They are that fleeting thought that starts the erosion of the intellect we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
And to anchor this theory in reality, he shares two incredibly dramatic anecdotes from his own experience in counseling and outreach.
Let's get into the mechanics of those stories because, man, they are intense.
Very intense.
The first one involves married couples struggling financially. They were having a genuinely hard time, and the husband asked his good friend to start driving his wife to work just to help out with logistics.
Right, and on the surface, that sounds like a practical favor between friends.
Yeah, totally normal. But there is an underlying power dynamic. The husband also owed this friend money. And the friend, capitalizing on both the physical proximity of the car rides and the leverage of the debt, ended up extorting the wife for sex in exchange for forgiving the husband's debt.
Oh, wow. It's just an absolute tragedy. But what shocked me was who the author holds responsible. I mean, he obviously condemns the predatory friend, but he lays a massive portion of the blame squarely on the husband's shoulders.
Yeah, he calls it a catastrophic, naive failure of the husband to protect his wife's boundaries.
Really?
Yes. In the author's framework, by placing her in that vulnerable, unsupervised, and unequal position with another man, the husband essentially abandoned his duty to guard the perimeter of his marriage.
Wow.
He ignored the reality of human nature, assuming friendship and decency would just override primal leverage.
He pulls absolutely no punches on that front. And the second story moves from a car into an office, specifically a religious outreach organization, what he calls Zikui Harabim. This is an organization literally dedicated to spreading holiness and religious values.
Right, the irony there is thick, and the author uses it very intentionally. The leadership of this organization made the decision to mix men and women in the same office space.
Okay.
Their underlying assumption was that because everyone was religious, because they were dedicating their lives to holy work, they were somehow insulated from basic human biology.
Right. They thought the spiritual environment would act as a shield.
Yeah.
The intellect over the animal.
Exactly.
But the shield failed. It led to affairs between married staff members.
It completely failed.
Mm.
And the author uses this disaster to explicitly state that good intentions, a holy environment, and even a shared religious mission do not override psychological realities.
Proximity plus human weakness equals disaster, regardless of how pious the people involved claim to be.
That's his exact argument.
Okay, well, I have to push back heavily on his proposed solution here, because his ultimate conclusion from these disasters is that men and women should ideally work in strictly segregated environments.
He does say that.
He even says, and I quote, "The days of having principles are over." And that we cannot rely on people stepping back and saying, oh, she's a married woman, I must respect that boundary.
Right.
I mean, in today's integrated world where we have human resources, professional boundaries, basic societal norms, Isn't that an incredibly cynical view of human nature? To assume every single person is just one water cooler interaction away from an affair.
I mean, it sounds deeply cynical, almost misanthropic to a modern ear.
Yeah.
But the author goes out of his way to clarify that he doesn't see this as cynicism, nor is it born out of a hatred for the opposite sex.
Okay. So how does he frame it?
He frames it as a sober, uncomfortable acknowledgement of millions of years of evolutionary drive.
But we aren't purely driven by evolution anymore. We've built civilizations.
We have. But the author argues those civilizations are really fragile constructs. In his view, the real enemy isn't the environment. The enemy is arrogance.
Arrogance.
Yeah. He believes that the person who says, "I have strong principles, it won't happen to me," is always the first one to fall because they drop their guard.
I see.
He thinks relying on modern concepts like professional boundaries when dealing with ancient primal drives is dangerously naive. It's like expecting a paper fence to stop a freight train. You don't walk into a burning building and trust your principles to keep you from catching fire. You simply don't walk into the fire.
Okay, I see the brutal internal logic there, even if it feels like a total rejection of modern social progress. He essentially believes that putting men and women in close daily proximity and asking them to just suppress their nature is setting a trap for them.
Exactly.
And to prove that this vulnerability to the fire isn't just some modern workplace phenomenon caused by modern stress, he takes us way back into history.
Oh, yeah. He uses the biblical blueprints of destruction. He pulls forward history's strongest, wisest figures to demonstrate that literally no one, no matter their pedigree, is immune to unbridled desire once the boundaries slip.
Let's examine those ancient cautionary tales because they beautifully illustrate his point about the intellect failing. First, he brings up King Solomon. Culturally, Solomon is synonymous with unmatched wisdom. He is framed as the smartest man who ever lived. But the author points out that Solomon was punished and ultimately his kingdom was torn away because his lust for his many foreign wives completely clouded that legendary wisdom.
Yeah.
It led him to tolerate and eventually build shrines for their idolatry.
The smartest man in the world couldn't outthink his own biology. His intellect, the very thing given to him to restrain his animal nature, was just completely bypassed by his desire.
Right. And then you have Samson. If Solomon represents the ultimate intellect, Samson represents ultimate physical power.
Right.
A literal superhero who could fight entire armies with his bare hands.
Right.
But his physical strength was completely useless against his own internal weakness. He was brought down entirely by his inability to control his desire for Delilah.
And the pattern the author is highlighting there is undeniable. Ultimate wisdom can't save you. Ultimate physical strength can't save you. If those titans fell, the author is asking, what chance does a regular person in a modern office have?
And he drives that point home with the most extreme historical example in the text, the Shittim incident, where the Israelites fell for the Midianite women.
Yes.
He mentions a wildly specific, almost shocking detail from the Talmud about a prominent leader named Zimri. The text claims Zimri engaged in 424 acts of intercourse in a single day during this event.
It's an overwhelming, mathematically absurd number.
Totally absurd.
But the author isn't interested in biological literalism here. He's using the Talmudic exaggeration to shock the reader into understanding the sheer, crushing weight of addiction.
Okay, so it's a metaphor.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, he is making a profound theological and psychological argument.
Yeah.
He isn't saying that sex itself is idolatry. He is arguing that the addiction to lust operates using the exact same psychological mechanics as idolatry.
Wait, how does that map onto each other? How does a physical addiction mirror ancient idolatry?
Well, in the ancient world, idolatry wasn't just about bowing to a statue. It was about surrendering your agency. You believed the rain god or the harvest god had absolute power over your survival.
Right.
So you gave up your own autonomy to serve it.
Right.
The author argues that unchecked lust does the exact same thing to the human mind. It strips a person of their free will. It overrides their intellect, and it strips away their dignity. It turns a strong, rational human being into a helpless slave serving a momentary dopamine hit.
Wow.
Just like the ancient idolater surrendered their humanity to a piece of carved stone, the person consumed by lust surrenders their humanity to their own physical impulses.
That is a staggering comparison. It elevates the conversation from just don't cheat on your spouse,
yes,
to a literal battle for your actual free will.
Yes, exactly.
So if the trap is this dangerous, if it can bypass the wisdom of Solomon and the strength of Samson, if the modern integrated workplace is an active minefield, and if repressing desire with mystical ascetic rules just turns the marriage into a ticking time bomb,
right,
How does a couple actually survive? I mean, how do you build that home instead of destroying it?
Well, this brings us to his ultimate solution. After tearing down modern boundaries and mystical restrictions alike, he offers his antidote to this poison. And surprisingly, it is radical openness.
Yes. Here's where it gets really interesting, because he explains that spouses have to stop hiding behind false modesty.
Yes.
He demands that they speak clearly, openly, and face-to-face about their physical needs. They need to articulate what brings them joy in the bedroom, and equally importantly, what creates distance between them.
He argues that the shame of nonsense, this fake, pious modesty where couples pretend they don't have physical needs, is precisely what destroys homes. He wants couples communicating their desires without fear and without hesitation.
Which is such a massive, beautiful paradox. You have a deeply traditional, rigid religious text, and a text that literally just argued for strict gender segregation in the office to avoid temptation.
Right.
And yet it is fiercely advocating for a level of unapologetic, radical transparency in the bedroom that honestly rivals the most progressive advice you'd get in modern couples therapy.
It is a striking juxtaposition. But within his internal logic, it is perfectly consistent. He is asking you to consider what actually constitutes a home.
Right.
A home isn't just an LLC where two people pay the mortgage, run errands, and raise kids. It requires actual intentional physical and mental connection.
The intellect and the body have to be completely aligned.
Exactly. They have to work together.
Yeah.
He has this beautiful chilling line in the text. When the mouth is silent, the heart distances itself.
Wow.
If you cannot speak to your partner about your most intimate reality, the void opens up. And we already know from the first half of our deep dive what rushes in to fill the void.
Right, the outside world.
Exactly. Open communication is the mechanism that keeps the intellect in charge of the desire. It guides the fire to warm the home rather than letting it run wild and burn it down.
That is incredibly powerful. Let's recap the journey we've taken through this source today. We started with the premise that unchecked desire causes a gradual, catastrophic fall, that subtle erosion of the intellect from a thought to an action. We explored how the author believes that false piety and strict mystical asceticism don't stop the fire, but actually poison intimacy by creating a dangerous void of neglect.
Yes.
We looked at how that void makes even the strongest and wisest people vulnerable to losing their free will, using biblical kings and warriors as proof. And finally, we arrived at his ultimate armor for a relationship, discarding fake modesty in favor of radical, open communication to keep the fire safely contained in the hearth of the home.
It's a really comprehensive, challenging worldview that forces us to look at the architecture of our own relationships.
Absolutely.
And as we wrap up, it raises a deeper question for you to consider in your own life. The author warns heavily against the physical spaces where we let our boundaries slip, like the integrated workplace or the unsupervised car ride. He sees those physical environments as the primary danger zones.
Right.
But building on his core insight about the slow erosion of boundaries, we have to ask, where are the invisible workplaces in your life today?
Ooh, that's a great question.
Where are the digital spaces, the late night scrolling habits, the casual text threads with acquaintances, where a lack of intention might be quietly, gradually eroding the walls of your own most important relationships? The fire doesn't always start with a match. Sometimes it starts with a glowing screen.
That is a profound thought to carry with you. Are you actively managing the fire, or are you ignoring the sparks? We want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. It is always deeply rewarding to explore these challenging perspectives together and to really examine the hidden roots of human behavior. Until next time, keep exploring.